This time on the show, doing it in the public domain.
And urban homes.
And Rickly and Artie's characters don't walk, they dance. All this and more on Comics Are Great. Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show recorded live every other Wednesday at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan. Comics.aadl.org. And this is the show where we talk about how to make comics, what it's like being a cartoonist, the thoughts that go into this medium that drives us all insane. And my name is Jersey Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist. And with me today, we got a big round of Skype guests. I gave producer or technical director Matt Dubay a challenge in roping in multiple Skype guests with multiple video streams. Thank you, Matt Dubay, Einstein85 on the Twitters, for all your hard work on this show.
Oh, I really enjoy the challenge.
you certainly sound like you enjoy the challenge.
We're only starting, what, 22 minutes late?
This happens every time we do the show. Is like something snaps in the Jenga tower and it comes apart just before we get started. Then, but you know what? For the folks who listen to this after the fact, they don't even know. So,
well, that's the idea, right?
But yeah, that is the idea. But I do think that it's a good idea for me every once in a while to say to you publicly, "Hey, good job, bro."
Do appreciate it.
and Eric Closter in the chat, EJK on the Twitters, and Tom Smith. I don't know Tom's Twitter handle. I don't know if he's even on Twitter.
No, he's one of the ones who's not on it.
Okay, he's one of the good ones. All right, but then we got to turn to our guests today because we got a really exciting man. There are so many layers to what I want to talk about today, guys. There's no way we're going to fit this in an hour. We got Brandon Perlow of NewParadigmStudios.com. Hi, Brandon.
Hi.
And then we've got just audio only. We've got Paul Mendoza, who also works for New Paradigm Studios.
Hello there.
And Paul, I hope you're feeling better soon. Paul is suffering from some kind of bug, so hopefully it won't interfere with the discussion today. And then last but not least, definitely not least, because this guy gets talked about a lot in all the different audio and video productions I've done in the past, is Rick Leonardi, man who needs zero introduction.
Go ahead and try anyway.
Rick Leonardi, man, okay, so, you know, one of the big ones that you're known for is Cloak and Dagger, but, man, you've had your hand on just about every Marvel character. Nobody draws Spider-Man the way you draw Spider-Man. And, I mean, and if I had my way, if you were interested, you would be the only artist for Spider-Man because your characters are, you know, some of the most graceful, gracefully drawn and gracefully moving characters on the page.
Thanks. Your lips to Joe Quesada's ears.
No, seriously. I mean, there was one issue of Cloak and Dagger where Spider-Man shows up and he literally dances with Dagger in the episode. And there's that scene where she lifts his mask and but just the grace of that scene is just it really I was gripped by it. I had an aesthetic arrest when I was reading your work. So, and
well,
I'm sure.
Thanks. I mean, Dagger, you know, it's functional part of her biography that she was a ballet dancer student. So I actually had to do quite a bit of background reference on classical ballet technique to get her posture correct and her movement. So I'm glad it paid off. I'm glad you were paying attention.
Well, yeah. But anyway, we're going to talk about that in the new book that you're working on now. The second issue just came out. So New Paradigm Studios, quick introduction, and then we're going to talk about a lot of things that come to mind as we think about this project. New comics company, studio, right? Brandon, I'm wondering if you can tell us about, I mean, what do you got? You got three books out now, right? No.
Two comics of Watson and Holmes are out. Second title will be out next month, and the third title will be out probably in January.
Okay. And you guys are on Comics Plus, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and then you also print books that you take to shows.
Yep.
Some interesting publishing model stuff going on there. But before we dive into that, I want to peel at the first layer of this. So, Brandon, you come to this comics business by way of Hollywood in the sense that you are a visual effects artist. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you worked for Jim Henson's Creature Shop. You did visual effects on X-Men, National Treasure. So I'm curious, this is the first thing I want to ask, is as you coming into this thing, is there any way that being a visual effects artist first and coming into it at comics, do you think, is there any way that that colors or changes the way you approach it? Like, how is your approach affected by that, if at all?
I think only on my book, Nimbus, where I'm doing digital artwork with it. I think everything else, I'm just trying to approach it as, you know, the book's as good comic book storytelling. Comics have always been my love first. Visual effects have just been a field that, you know, that, you know, supported me quite well. And, you know, it's been challenging, but it's not my first love.
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking of is something Keith Giffen said years ago. And Keith Giffen is, you know, he's well known for his very opinionated stances on things. And he said, I'm paraphrasing now because I don't want him to come after me, but he said something along the lines of one of the problems with comics is that everybody who's working in comics has only read comics. So mm-hmm. I'm just curious, you know, and I mean, you're saying you had a lifelong love of comics. I'm just curious of working in another creative field where you're doing a different kind of visual storytelling. I'm wondering if, like, if you notice anything different when you're working on this stuff. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think I'm always looking at how things work all the time. I mean, that's always going in the back of my mind because it's like we're always having to, like, make things look real and visual effects and believable. So that always clouds me a lot of times when, you know, looking at stuff. So I'm always having that going on. But other than that, I try and look at other influences besides comics, you know, just other TV shows, you know, other books. But yeah, I mean, really all that the effects business really does is really, you know, push your sense of reference and your sense of, like, observation. It really, it's just taken to another degree.
Okay, so
I didn't really know this about Brandon, that he had a movie background, and in a way that's part of a very long tradition. You know, they tell stories of the original guys who invented the comic book vocabulary back in the 30s and the 40s. A lot of them learned their craft essentially by sitting in movie theaters and watching the movies of the time over and over and over again. And people talk about watching Citizen Kane 30 or 40 times mm-hmm. in a row.
Wow.
You know, to absorb the shot structure and the sequencing and the camera movement and all that kind of stuff, and finding analogs to bring into comic books. So Brandon's just the latest generation of guys who are, you know, cross-pollinating and making us all better for it.
Well, you yourself, Rick, you were saying earlier about, you know, doing reference for dancing. And I'm sure that when you are in a creative field, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, I teach some comics workshops mm-hmm. and classes. And I'm telling my students is that you always have to keep that analytic eye open. Is whenever something grips you and moves you, you have to stop and ask, why did that happen? What did that person do to make me feel that feeling? Because that you're adding tools to your utility belt of being at the page, right? So even plays, like learning blocking by watching how the plays are staged up and blocked out. Everything can be a source of learning for visual storytelling, right? But I'm also glad to not hear the whole, like, well, I wanted to make a comic that felt like a film. Comics has its own unique magic to it, right?
Yeah. Well, getting back to Keith Giffen's quote to you, I mean, I think what he's saying, and this is true, that, you know, comic books is a sequential thing. You know, it relies a lot on fan enthusiasm. So it's way too easy, frankly, to get kind of derivative. I mean, people do the same panels over and over and over again. And they forget what the original reason was for that panel and why you employ that panel in that spot at that time. It's useful to step back from the industry, step back from the medium, go to another medium to kind of refresh your memory about, you know, okay, why am I using establishing shots, or what are establishing shots good for? What are establishing shots even? You know, sometimes you have to kind of get out of comic books to re-educate yourself.
I think that is a terrific point. And I do think that's probably where Keith was going with that statement. So talking about derivations, let's talk about Watson and Holmes a little bit, shall we? And an interesting thing about this book is I put out a call on Twitter just this morning to say, like, hey, everybody who listens to the show, if you could do one public domain character, what would it be and how would you change it? And one of the responses that I got was remember, everyone, no fair choosing Sherlock Holmes unless you make an Egyptian wizard, because that's the only thing not done yet. And yes, Sherlock Holmes has been covered a lot. Oh, and by the way, as a parenthetical statement, everybody, I know that the actual status of Sherlock Holmes being a public domain character is, there's like a little bit of a dispute about that. We could put a link in the show notes to a TechDirt article on this point. Somebody representing the Conan Doyle estate is contesting whether or not it actually is in the public domain. But this is where I want to go with it, actually, is like, so you guys reimagined Sherlock Holmes, and you yourself even said in other interviews that he's a very popular character. You know, there's been the movies with Robert Downey Jr., there's that new BBC show, there's lots and lots of different iterations and derivations on this idea. Is that not a case for why the public domain is so important? Because something from so long ago can be breathed life in all sorts of new ways and create new versions that are completely, you know, for this generation. Like, for instance, your version of Sherlock Holmes lives in New York. He's not a British guy, and he's African-American, you know, and, you know, there's different things that trickle down in the story as a result of those two initial choices. But I'm just wondering, was it an intentional thing to go for the public domain, or was it just like an intuitive thing? Like, oh, you know, it'd be cool.
It was pretty much Paul and I, you know, around New Year's, we were talking about, like, why hasn't this been done? And, you know, the more we thought about it and coming up with ideas, we just decided, let's go for it and let's try and, you know, see how far it goes.
There was something very natural about the concept, actually, when you think about Holmes' connection to the streets and the fact that he's not a detective that goes to, like, well, technically, it depends on what story. He's not a detective that works for the high and mighty or the most powerful people, but a lot of his cases involve people on the streets, and we figured that it might be, why not take that concept and have Holmes more streetwise, more modern, and in a world that is in a world where they've not had a Sherlock Holmes sort of, you know, character involved in. I mean, really, this is just something we're just like, wait, why hasn't somebody done this? This would be a really interesting way of telling the stories.
I'm curious, Paul, that was an interesting thing that you said there that I want to grab onto and jump off of. And I'm hoping all you guys can respond to this since you're all the creative team on this. You talked about Holmes is like the guy of the streets kind of idea. So do you think when approaching an intellectual property that is available to use like that, like one of my dreams in life is to actually do a graphic novel version of Pippi Longstocking, but I don't know what I would do with it. I haven't really thought about it hard. It's just I love the book since I was a kid, and I would love to draw her doing all those amazing things. But something you said there, Paul, I think is really interesting is kind of getting to what makes the character work. You know, it's like going back to Spider-Man, Peter Parker. As long as you have him hurting for money, having a bad social life, Aunt May is sick, and he's got to fight a guy, you've got a good Spider-Man story, right? There's like an essence to what makes the character tick, right? Great power, great responsibility, and all that. Do you think that that's important? And if so, how do you get to that? What's your investigation process? Or is this something where it's kind of like just talking with buddies and it's off the cuff? I wonder who wants to jump in on that one.
I think Paul and I initially were talking about what we liked about Sherlock Holmes and what we felt didn't work in Sherlock Holmes in today's times, like what would need to be redone or at least altered a bit to make it more current and actually fit with what we're doing with the changes.
There was just something also about the fact that there were overlooked characters in the stories too. Lestrade was always kind of just, I don't know if the right word's like a foil. He was just never really used much in a way that I think could have been helpful to the stories. And I think that the character of Eileen Adler, I think they've kind of done, to be totally honest, I haven't seen enough of the new Sherlock series, but I know that she's in it. But we have concepts for her as well. There are characters in these stories that I think really kind of transfer over well to modern times. I mean, you look at Watson and his connection to the British war in Afghanistan in his time period, and the modern wars that we now have in Afghanistan. It's so many things here just come over nicely, can be retold, translated different, it's just slightly, but it's still, what's interesting about it is it really the story still keeps its essence. As Sherlock Holmes is still somebody who lives above a bookstore, or in this case, an R&B store. And it's so many elements can just be brought over, and I now realize I don't know if that is exactly what you were asking.
Well, <you're,
laughs> but
well, I wonder if Rick can weigh in on this.
Well, yeah,
yeah. I think.
Please, Rick.
The answer comes in two parts. I mean, the first part is that Sherlock Holmes is, and the boys have heard me say this before, but I mean, if you really took a survey of successful literary franchises in the English canon, the English language, I mean, it would be hard really to find a character that supported more interpretations, more riffs, more various mediums, media than Sherlock Holmes. Probably the most successful literary franchise there is. And it's not because Conan Doyle is some sort of amazing writer. It's because he happened to stumble on something really, really essential that people respond to, you know, across cultures and across times. And it has to do, I think, probably with the puzzle solving, the idea that by paying attention to life, you can make sense of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. And solving crimes and righting wrongs doesn't hurt either. That said, I think what Brandon and Paul have the genius of this is that their character has the opportunity here to break new ground. I mean, if there's a limitation to the original Holmes, it's the Englishness, it's the rootedness in the Victorian era, the fact that Holmes,
yep,
the Irene Adler. Is that kind of that cramped, not quite romantic thing? I mean, that's a function of Doyle's time and his discomfort with that whole theme. I mean, we could go places with that Doyle never dreamed. At the same time, I mean, Paul was talking about, or Brandon was talking about Lestrade. Lestrade is a foil. He needs to be kind of. Clumsy and two steps behind Holmes, and that again is an artifact of Doyle's approach. That's not going to work in the present day. Our cops are way better than that, which means that our Holmes is walking a much finer line than the original Holmes did. Our Holmes has to be better than the bad guys, but he has to work very delicately with the cops. It's a much tighter seam, and his status. The original Holmes, you got the sense that right or wrong, solve the case or not, he had a comfortable life. No one was really going to bother him in 221 Baker Street. He wasn't going to get sued. He wasn't going to get arrested. The cops weren't going to shut him down. Our guy, not so much. Our guy could easily, you know, step wrong and get into some serious trouble. Either way, bad guys or cops.
And in this story, too, there's a respect that he has for Lestrade.
Right.
And no, and it appears in the story, like stuff we were talking about last night, that he has to pretty much respect her jurisdiction and try to work with her as best as possible. He can't afford to lose her as an ally.
Right. No, I think I think those two axes at least present us opportunities to add to the Sherlock Holmes canon in ways that nobody else really has the chance to do. So.
Well, I think that's what you guys are all talking about, too, is I think this is an interesting case for public domain. You know, this is something that goes round and round where public domain or copyright laws keep getting extended to being longer and longer and longer as vested interests fight for to hang on to their beloved properties. But there's an enriching that happens when a property goes into the public domain. You get to do things like what you guys are talking about. And I think it challenges. I mean, the fear is that a bunch of cheapskates are going to come in and just try to make a bunch of cheap garbage property just to like cash in on something that's popular, but I think that that's just noise where something where somebody carefully thinks about what makes the initial idea work, what makes it tick, that's what's going to rise up. And that BBC Sherlock show is pretty popular, and I've seen a few episodes, it's pretty good. right? I myself was, when I first heard about that show, I was like, what, modern day, whatever. And then as soon as I watched it, I was like, oh, I see. It can work and even go into interesting places like what you guys are doing with your book. So real quick, I want to hit on some of these other points here. So you guys are doing an interesting publication strategy. I'm sure you guys all saw, it was passed around a lot yesterday, that Jim Zub article.
Yep, saw that.
That's at jimzub.com, and so he posted basically how what a deadly business this independent comics publishing in the direct market can be, and you know, dispelling the myth that we're all getting tons and tons of money off of this. And I love that. I love that whole aspect of being a cartoonist is I've got half of the people I meet go, oh, that
I
sounds
never
like...
I never heard this myth.
You never heard this?
I Charles Schultz.
Well, you have like a couple of people like Charles Schultz and Jim Davis who like really, you know, make a real good go of it. And then you got some people who think that that's what every cartoonist is doing, right? And then you got the other half who thinks that we're just a bunch of children who don't have real jobs. But that, there's well, nothing.
Those would be the wives.
to which I proudly refute by saying, well, yes, yeah, it is great. We do get to remain children forever. That's not a bad way to make a living. But anyway, you know, one of the things that Jim Zub did is he basically pointed out like how the economics break down when you're doing independent comics publishing, and pointed out that, you know, you're kind of operating at a loss most of the time if you're doing monthly independent magazine style books. So what you guys are doing is actually pretty interesting to me, because what you're doing is you're going digital first, printing them as you need them for shows, right, and then possibly collecting as a graphic novel or seeking a publisher. You know, is that the plan, is to keep your options open while the thing is being produced and using digital as your monthly
Absolutely.
Magazine?
Absolutely.
Yep. I'm also taking
a look at getting into, you know, figuring out how we can get the books into overseas in the French market, because the French comic book market's far bigger than the American one in terms of, like, readership. And I'd like to get a translated copy of the books very soon, and just see if we can get them, you know, again, first digitally as well, because I know that Comixology and Comics Plus have French editions of their books, as well as other, digital distributors.
Okay. So, yeah, actually, that is an interesting thing to think about, is those markets simultaneously instead of just focusing on North America diamond distribution, right? Because that is so economically difficult for, especially if you're not a superhero book too, right? Or like, I think like Watson Holmes has like a niche enough thing like The Walking Dead, where it's a very specific and popular genre/ intellectual property, right? But you know, if you're doing anything outside of either like a really, really popular niche or superhero stuff, it's pretty tough in that market, right? Go ahead.
I think some of it has to do with a lot of the major comic book press sites. They focus purely on Marvel and DC and a few Image books, and it's very hard to get them to like give you press. I mean, it's really, you know, if they don't really say, hey, this is an awesome book, no one's going to know that you're an awesome book and pick you up.
that is part of the puzzle, isn't it? This is the whole chicken and egg thing. It's like,
yeah,
well, what do retailers want to hear about? What do the fans want to hear about? And you know, you get these little breakthrough things where it's like, hey, support independent publishers and give them a chance. Well, how about you rephrase that to say, no, this book is just awesome and you should just want it.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is a big issue. So one of the other things you're doing on Comics Plus that I think is kind of cool, and this is something I've talked about myself in other shows, is you're getting double duty out of the work by releasing a black and white version and a color version digitally, and the black and white version's a little cheaper than the color
version.
Actually,
they're the same price.
Are they? Are they the same price?
Both 99 cents. We just released, you know, the black and white one for people who just want to see Rick Leonardi's art in the raw. Basically, just Rick's art with the lettering. That's it.
All five of them.
No, this is actually pretty. This is a cool idea, and this is something where I'm wondering if the art style that you chose, Rick, was partially because of this, or was it just an after the fact? You're like, you know what, this art looks really good on its own. Nothing against Paul there. The colors are gorgeous on it, but there is something kind of nice about being able to have the choice of seeing that really soft pencil art that you did, Rick.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about it is my thinking about it has evolved. I thought, you know, in the beginning, I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do without an inker? And my first impulse was to try and make dark, crisp pencils that would scan and basically stand in for the inks themselves, which is a kind of an artificial way of thinking. I've since come around to the view that, oh, screw it, just draw it, and it's going to be its own sort of black plate. It's a black plate that wouldn't work, you know, if I were to hand it over to an inker. But at the same time, it's a black plate that no one's seen before, kind of thing. I think we are actually kind of creating a not a new medium, but a sort of a, you know, a medium subprime or something, some sort of, you know, subset of pencils here. Well, so it's interesting. It's been an interesting experience, and from the technical standpoint, it's been an education.
Well, you guys remember Epic Illustrated, that magazine that Marvel did back in the, what was it, the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah, sure
and,
do.
And it had that deluxe printing on it, so you could have, you know, like just soft pencil comics because it wasn't being printed on newsprint. I don't know if it was that Baxter paper or what, but it was a nicer printing. And that technology is a lot more available now, so you get to do this, right? That whole inking thing was a limitation of the technology at the time, although that does make inking even more of an art form now because we don't need to do it. So yeah, we have more visual options. But I just, one of the things and this is where I want to do like a little promo for the book for everybody who's listening or watching. You got to check these pages out because Rick's stuff is always graceful, first of all, but it takes on this whole new kinetic kind of feel with these scribbly shadows and all of these sketchy lines. Everything's now, it's like it's vibrating with life, with those graceful forms. That was my first reaction when I opened flipped open the book on my tablet was, it's like, oh, he's not inking. And then I looked at it again and went, oh, you know, it's like I haven't seen this stuff look this energetic since Spidey 2099.
Well, yeah. You know, I'm afraid that a lot of what you're seeing is that the lines I hadn't quite erased. but yeah, you know, from that standpoint, it's an educational tool, kids. Yeah, I've heard tell that there are pencilers who can start at the upper left corner of a page and work their way to the lower right and never make a mistake, but I'm definitely not one of them. If you want to see real trench warfare on a page, come buy this book.
there's the tagline for the ad for the book. And Paul, I swear to God, we're going to get to talking about the coloring on this thing. But real quick, since we're on the topic of, you know, the fluidity and vitality of your forms, you know, you hinted before we started recording that you've got a treatise or something like a piece that you harangue people with in terms of capturing fluidity on the page. I know this is something my students struggle with all the time, is how do you find the moment that is a static moment that feels like it's moving? Right, and I haven't found the words to do. I'm like, well, you know, it's the spine, it's the through line, everything like that. But like, how do you break it down, Rick?
Well, I think actually the point I was making. I mean, in the case of Dagger, which is the character I always use when I do this little riff, it is the through line. But I go back again to the reference work I did with classical ballet and classical ballet, at least from the point of view of the ballerina, it's the sternum. The sternum always leads first. So if you look at Dagger, she's generally leading with her chest the whole time. And that's straight out of classical ballet. And it's absolutely integral to the way she moves. So that in essence, you have to pair her up with Cloak, of course. And what you wind up with is this great duality. you know, she's her concavity or her convexity is mirrored by his, you know, his concavity, his tallness by her smallness, his darkness to her lightness, that kind of thing. So that these are all the ways, there are a whole catalog between the two of them. There's this enormous catalog of ways of characterization that have nothing to do with their specific biographies or their names or their, even how they, their faces, or how they sound. There's all these visual ways of distinguishing one character from the other, and characterizing them. And the two of them, like I say, I mean, the two of them are the basis for this little lecture that I give when people get me going.
So you're thinking about this when you're doing Watson and Holmes too, I'll bet. Like, how can I express the character through the gesture? Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean, you know, haven't really evolved it that to that extent. But again, I mean, Holmes is a slighter guy, kind of. I think we've established him as a kind of a neatnik. He's a little, you know, he's a little particular about things. He's more of a spidery guy. The guy I actually use for a model works at my daughter's school as a security guard, and he's got that kind of lanky, kind of almost double jointed feel to him, and so that's him. And in contrast, what you got in Watson, of course, is this big, you know, linebacker type of character. And that's, you got to stick with that, and you got to carry that through, and that's one way of signaling, you know, characterization, one way of defining each character to the reader, establishing them, establishing their identities to the reader without, you know, without hanging a tag on them or having them speak or anything like that.
Right. This is Watson. He's grumpy. With the caption box, right?
Yeah.
No, but one of the things that I noticed in the book is there's a shot of watching Watson walk. We were behind him, you know, looking at him from behind, and he has this. You rendered him as like with this nice boldish contour to emphasize like the roundness of his upper body, and then the leg is bowed in just such a way to almost look like it's doing this cartoon sag as he's coming down on it. It's really neat how you can straddle that line between pure cartoon and representation in your work, and yeah, it's there if you look for it, that kind of heaviness to his form versus Holmes's lankiness. So
yeah, well, I mean, it speaks to, I think one of the points that you probably cover in your teaching is all the ways, you know, as a cartoonist that you're doing your job the way it ought to be done, and part of the cartoonist's job is characterization. And it's not just, you know, getting the insignia right on the uniform. It's, you know, it's how the guy in the uniform moves. And that's, you know, it's just barely scratching the surface. It's a big topic. Let me tell you.
Can I twist your arm into coming back for a full hour just on that topic? Because I'm dying to this is one of my favorite subjects in comics, is that sense of dynamism. And not just Kirby dynamism where it's like a scream, but also like the, you know, the kind of graceful dynamism that you see in your work. So anyway, yeah, we our librarian Sharon Iverson is about ready to come in for our book talk segment, so we gotta close pretty soon here. But I want to give time to talk to Paul because this is an interesting thing. Paul's credit on the book, he's not the colorist, he's the color artist. Was that a deliberate choice?
You know, I don't know.
That's a justin question.
That is a justin question.
There's an implication in that word choosing there, and I like it. Because the colorist is a lot different than the days when we used to cut ruby lith back in the old days.
Oh, Dr. Martin thinks I remember you.
So I'm wondering, I'm just curious, you know, what tools do you use? Are you a Photoshop guy?
Right now it is Photoshop, yeah. Okay. And it's kind of interesting. It's still an ongoing process. You'll notice some differences as you go through issues 1 and 2, and that's because the whole thing is evolving as we're doing this. It's like, you know, I think I like how this looks better. I like how this looks better. You know, I would say that it really is something that it is also, like everything else in this book, it's turned out to be a real group process. we're taking everybody's advice in. And there's, I don't know if it's really even mentioned, but Rick has been very integral to the story, for instance, being the Sherlock fan that he is. It's interesting. Everybody's had a say on various parts of the book. And right now, we're moving all the pages to, I guess you could say, towards a more vivid color scheme as opposed to some of the more really watercolory, washed out sort of, almost like, you know, paint. I don't know, how would you call that, Brandon, the first issue? The extremely watercolory sort of look?
Yeah, I would say it's very subdued.
Subdued. It's one of those things where as we're looking at everything as a whole, I mean, we are a new company just trying to figure these things out. Now that we're seeing what the second issue looks like, we're getting an idea now as to how we really want this whole project to look. So that's one of the great things about digital, is that you can go back and modify things to your heart's content. It's also a bad thing, mind you, but right now what's happening is that we're able to fine tune things well enough to where once we do put out a trade paperback of this, it's really going to be pretty neat looking. Right now, I think my favorite is though the Noir edition, because this is one of the first times I think can remember where I've actually gotten to see Rick Leonardi's like pencils. Everything has been inked over, and you lose. And it's not to diss inkers, because the inkers brings their own, you know, interpretation of things to the artwork.
Absolutely,
it is just
so
nice. Yeah, it's so nice to see somebody's pencils in this form, because you realize how much disappears, how much was there, what the intent was comes through a lot clearer. And even though our colors are becoming more vivid, we're trying to think of something that's going to be more complimentary to his pencils.
Well, I can't let a compliment like that pass without paying it back. I mean, Paul's colors, whether he's using a desaturated palette or whether he's bringing it up a little bit brighter, as you'll see in issue two, he's getting incredible depth. Depth like I've never seen in a comic book. And panel by panel, there's such great depth of field that one of the complaints I always have about comic books is how the reader's eye just skips right to a comic book. I mean, you can digest a comic book in 5 minutes unless something stops you, unless something grabs you and holds you. And Paul's color is doing that to me anyway. It's making me really study each panel as I go along. So that's a good thing.
Is this just about making the book look good, or is there a storytelling element in your guys' discussions?
It's an introduction. No, in Paul's case, it's an introduction of air and space to every panel. Every panel, the panels don't lie there as two-dimensional squares. They're actually little cubes. There's like a little atmosphere in there that's worth examining. And that's all to do with Paul and the color.
So I'm curious, Paul. I mean, what are you thinking about? Like, because even in the first issue, there's some different color themes going on. There's cooler scenes, there's warmer scenes in the book, and I'm wondering, like, if you could explain, like, just a few of the things that are. Do you have like a mental sort of checklist of, okay, here's the things that I'm going to. If I don't know where to go with the color on this, here's my go-to list of what to think about.
Generally, the mood of the scene, what's going on. You going with cooler, more subdued colors when. For instance, during the first issue, when Watson is in the hospital, it's generally a pretty grim sequence all the way through with both the patients coming in. So washing everything out, bringing things down to a very cold feeling was what we were trying to go for here. You make everybody feel something with the colors you choose. And it really, I think, that's what we were going for. You try to think of, you know, when things are possibly moving towards a little more hope or a little more mystery, moved it to a little warmer tones when he was outside.
Right.
You know, so there is something to that.
Right. So it's back to your original point. I mean, storytelling is what we're about, and what Paul's describing is a process of using color to tell the story. So, indeed, he is a color artist and not merely a colorist. So
we have solved it. We've cracked the nut. So yes, color artist is now the term I think that we should use. And also, when you're talking about people like John Workman, letter artist, right, or sound artist, I would call them.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've been saddled with a lot of bad nomenclature over the years. first the word comics, and then all of the names of the jobs within. Penciler, yeah, that just means you're just putting drawings on a pencil, right? Okay, well, we're going to get to book recommendations. Sharon's here. Sharon Iverson is in the building. But real quick,
hi there.
I don't know if you guys could see her from that viewing angle, but she is here, and we're gonna do some book talks. We're gonna do some. We always close the show with some book recommendations of, okay, well, we got you excited about this medium. What should you read next besides Watson at Home? So we're gonna talk about where they can get that. I just want to say one more thing that Brandon, you said in an interview recently that I thought was really, really interesting. You said Craig Thompson is redefining the medium of comics. You spoke very excitedly about Habibi. Have you read that yet, Sharon?
I was going to recommend that, actually. Yeah, that is quite possibly the best book I've read in the past 5 years or so.
It's outstanding.
And you mentioned Tale of Sand, too, which I recently finished. And that book is really good. And talk about color use, right?
Incredible.
Yeah.
But I think Habibi's just, like, on such another level. I mean, it's like it really takes comic book narrative to the highest point I've seen it in years.
Wow! This is another thing that I think is really cool is that often when you hear interviews with people who are in comics, you know, they're like, "What are you reading right now?" I'm like, "Oh, Batman." I think anything Grant Morrison does, and it's cool to hear people talking about like dipping from such a wide variety of stuff. One of the arguments I get into with my friends, a friendly argument, is that debating whether or not it's all just comics or whether it has provinces. And to some people, there are some very, very clear provinces with a clear border, and you don't look outside, you don't look across that border, right? But then there's other people, and this is what I was picking up from your statement, Brandon, is that there's some people who are like, is it sequential narrative? I'll read it. Give it to me, right? As long as it's good. So anyway, so what is it? Just real quick, if you could sum it up in one point, what is Craig Thompson doing that's so different than what everybody else is doing?
I think he made like a very epic story, and he put many different layers in the storytelling of that story. It's about 300 pages or so. So I mean, it's huge. There's a beautiful movement to the art, especially with his ink. I mean, I can't really put it into words, but I mean, it's massive, and I think it's even better than Blankets.
Wow. Better than Goodbye Chunky Rice? That's my favorite so far of his work.
No, I haven't read that, to be honest. I've been reading lots of other stuff lately. I mean, of course I read, you know, the Big Two stuff and some Image stuff, you know, Love Saga, you know. I just picked up a book called Northlanders. I didn't read it when it came out, but I ordered a whole bunch of other ones just to, you know, keep reading it because it's a great book.
Well, see, that's a perfect segue into talking book talks. Mm-hmm. So one last time, Watson and Holmes can be found at newparadigmstudios.com. It's on Comics Plus.
That's right.
And before we end the show, we'll talk about any appearances that you guys are doing, although convention season is winding down as we're heading towards the holidays. But we'll talk about other places where they can find it. So Sharon Iverson of the Ann Arbor District Library, comics.adl.org. Hey, Sharon.
Hey.
Good to see you.
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that you have a pile of books. A short stack of books to talk about. So what do you got? Brandon and Paul and Rick, if you guys want to think up any books that you want to talk up in a second, feel free, but you don't have to. You know, I don't think I warned you guys about this. So
we'll
let Sharon start while you guys think of what you want to recommend. What do you got, Sharon?
Well, I didn't exactly plan this, but it ends up that I had a little pile of books over time piled up that have something to do with the water. I kind of call them my salty dogs, but some are set in fresh water, so that's not quite true. So, of course, number one.
Oh gosh!
Is
yes,
Cat and Cat.
You had to bring Cat and Cat
into
this,
and you know it's sort of.
Let's get it on camera. Here we go.
Okay.
So, yeah, you guys on Skype are not going to be able to see this, but after the fact, you'll be able to see this, and the folks watching on the live stream can see this. So, yes, Captain Cat, former shark hunter, which I did with my wife, Anne. So,
you know, Captain Ahab.
Yeah.
Kind of a, you know, not Watson and Holmes derivation, but, you know, anyway, it's a fun story about a captain who has given up shark hunting but finds that the sharks will not leave him alone. And my favorite scene is showing all three of the main characters, Captain Lau and Lady Sophie?
Lady Sophie.
Who's constantly barfing because she doesn't have sea legs. And then...
That's ship's cook Maggie.
Maggie, who is envisioning as the shark is jumping to take Captain Lau of what dishes she could make out of.
She has a fascination with bully beef.
Food. Yes, food. And what I like about this is that it's truly a salty tale, complete with a glossary in the back for those people who maybe are landlocked like myself, and that the terms that you use are actually historically accurate, right?
Well, we went to our local library got a book called Sea Language Goes Ashore to get reference on this. And yes, we used a lot of idioms from sailor talk, like bully beef. I forget some of the other ones. Stow your gaff.
Yes.
And as we were writing the book, Anne said, like, we really ought to put a glossary in this thing. I was like, we don't need to. I mean, that's the fun of comics, is when I was reading Dr. Doom speeches and he says, you poltroon or something, I'd be like, what is that? And I'd look it up. You know, mm-hmm. But she said, people aren't going to be able to look up these terms. Let's put it in the book.
That's right.
But yes, actually, that's in my Etsy store. There's still some copies left, but we did a limited run. So
okay. Looking forward to what else Captain Lau gets into.
Yeah, this is just for backstory of everybody. This was. It was my cat's 15th birthday. and Ann and I were talking about, like, what are we going to do for his birthday? What are we going to do? He's 15. You know, we didn't think he was going to make it this far. And so I said, well, let's do a comic about him. And I thought we were going to do, like, the story of how I found him, you know. Mm-hmm. And instead, Ann's like, no, let's do something fictional. And one of her favorite movies is The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which is a Rex Harrison film about a ghost of a sailor. She's like, what if we did Lau as Rex Harrison?
Now that you mentioned that, he does look like Rex Harrison.
We totally ripped off the outfit.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So.
I did not know that little tidbit.
So, yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, it's just a comic of my cats, if you like that kind of thing.
Another salty sea dog is a couple of kids' books, comic books, Saltwater Taffy, The Seaside Adventures of Jack and Benny. And I find that amusing, Jack Benny. But at any rate, Matthew Lou, I think is how you pronounce his name, is presents to you a really fun story that also I'm fascinated by his illustrations. The characters are totally cartoony. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the hands are not even, you know.
Rendered as individual fingers,
they look
right?
like potatoes with lines across them sometimes. but the backdrop scenery out at the sea.
Very lush backgrounds.
Very lush. And so that works together to tell this kind of, you know, out of, you know, reality experience of this giant whale that's trying to attack and eat a giant baby squid, and how Jack and Benny get tied up in the whole saga. And so yet another tale that will go down in the annals of the Chowder Bay folklore.
Oh, so, cool. Who put this out? Who published this? Oni Press.
Oni, yeah.
Oh, they always do such interesting things. You know, this it just gives me kind of like a Tezuka feel, but with like an American vibe to it. You know, like Tezuka does like those rich backgrounds and like cartoony foreground characters. Yeah, really cool.
That I kind of found fun. By Carol and Matt Dembiski, Mr. Big, A Tale of Pond Life. And it's done in full color. It's very richly done. About, you know, first you think it's going to be somewhat idyllic, except for on the cover, Mr. Big is a snapper turtle that his eye just kind of unsettles you.
Yeah.
And it basically is kind of an environmental story, but the characters are fascinating, and it sets you up realizing that in a pond, it's not just daytime struggle for life and death and survival, it's nighttime as well, and how the snapper, Mr. Big, is kind of the lord of the entire land. The story begins to turn when some fish and, I don't know, frogs begin to become disgruntled with Mr. Big and decide, you know, he's really ruining. He's killing our children. You know, he's ruining pond life here. I think we need to take care of this problem.
Uh-huh.
So they go talk to a murder of crow and decide that, you know, maybe they can take out Mr. Big. But what they don't realize and understand is that if they take out Mr. Big, there may be something else even worse.
There's always a bigger fish.
Waiting
yeah.
in the wings. So it's sort of an environmental story, but it's pretty dramatic for a little kid's book.
So it's like an epic version of Mr. Bear, or yeah, Mr. Bear Squash You All Flat, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the nature Glen bully and how the other animals conspire against him.
Exactly, and it's compelling enough that you're kind of going, well, who is going to win this? Is this new Asian, whatever he is, fish that walks across land going to take out Mr. Big? Is Mr. Big going to take out the fish? Are the crows going to take them both out?
Wow.
You know, what's going to happen?
Very cool.
So, yep, that's fun. And then I just finished
Sailor Twain by Mark Siegel,
which is I guess it was perfect for the days that I read it on. It was so gloomy, and this entire book in black and white.
Here's
is
more
just,
of that soft pencil stuff we were talking about earlier. Yeah,
it's just so wrapped in the fog and the gloom of the Hudson River and this captain who has rescued a mermaid that was hanging on to the side of his boat, keeping her secret and becoming more and more intrigued by her. But who is she? And, you know, what is happening to other strange characters on board? Some can't leave the boat. The Lorelei, you know, all of this adds up to amazing mythology and stories, mystery, the whole bit. It's a lot of fun.
And this is published through First Second.
Mm-hmm.
Enough said. Mm-hmm. Everything they do is amazing. But yes, nothing but great things I've been hearing about this book.
Yeah.
I've yet to read it, but it looks gorgeous. Mark mm-hmm. Siegel knocked that out of the park, it looks like.
Yeah. So that's my salty dog stuff.
Okay. Well, we've got an event coming up at the Ann Arbor District Library.
Yes,
this
we do.
Sunday.
This Sunday, 1 to 3 p.m.
We're going to be visited by this gal, so I brought her book to do a
Yay.
Book talk on. Winters in Lavelle by Casey Van Heist, which is basically, can you open it up? Cause that's, yeah,
sure.
There we go. The cover's kind of shiny. It's basically, Casey herself has described the book as Chronicles of Narnia, but with just two of the kids, but it's so much more than that. It's, and I say this with all love and respect to C.S. Lewis, but it's so much more than Chronicles of Narnia. If you like fantasy and deer men and dragon men and kids rising to the challenge of being dropped into an adventure, it's also really, really funny. There's really fun characters. It's one of my favorite comics on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey is going to be at the Ann Arbor District Library for the Comics Artist Forum 1 to 3 p.m.
1 to 3 p.m.
Sunday, December 3rd.
She's coming to us through Skype, and she's going to talk about storytelling, manga storytelling,
That's
which,
right.
of course, is what she does. So.
Yeah, so her work is definitely influenced by manga.
Yep.
But so that's a free event that we hold at the Ann Arbor District Library first Sunday of every month, where we have a guest mm-hmm. speaker come in, and it's also just a chance to network and socialize with local cartoonists. And then I also wanted to throw this one on everybody's radar, talking about independent books, The Hero Code by Jamie Gamble and Jonathan Rector. Jonathan Rector is a guy who should be drawing every superhero comic in the world. Talk about energy. This guy, he has that shouty kind of energy like Jack Kirby we were talking about earlier. It's like when his character punches something, it's like, it's from the astral plane. It's like an Asgardian punch. The whole world falls apart. When one of his characters punched something. It's just the guy's amazing, and, you know, Jamie better be paying him well to hang on to him, because I think a lot of people are going to be coming for this guy eventually. But it's also just a great story. Jamie Gamble's a great writer, great guy, and I just thought we should point people at a superhero book that you can read that's not from the big two. So that's pretty different stuff, Winters in Lavelle and Heroes Code. It's not tied together like your stuff was, Sharon.
Oh, wow. Well, that was by accident.
Hey, guys, Brandon or Rick or Paul, do you guys have any book recommendations that you would throw out at people that they should check out?
Again, I was mentioning Northlanders so far. It's been pretty good. I've just ordered some more of them. I've been going to a place called cheapgraphicnovels.com and just getting a whole bunch of other books, getting some extra issues of Razzle, which I just was surprised how much I liked it.
Jeff Smith, yeah. R-A-S-L. Is the way that one's spelled. What was it that you liked so much about it specifically?
I just like the high concept idea of like traveling through dimensions, and it's like it wasn't what I was expecting it to be. I just had no idea what that story was about. So, but everyone kept talking about it, so I got the first issue of it a couple of months ago, and I'm like, "Oh, this is really good." So I just ordered a whole bunch of them recently during a Black Friday sale.
Oh yeah, good move. Okay, so Razzle and Northlanders, which will be linked in the show notes. Eric Kloster diligently captures all of these names that we throw out during the show so that people can.
And of course, Habibi, if you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that at your library, probably?
Yeah, it's at our library.
Yeah, the Ann Arbor District Library has a pretty impressive comics collection.
But we don't have Watson and Holmes yet.
Well, you had to get the print edition.
I know.
Brandon.
we have the first issue as a noir edition that was for the New York Comic Con. We still have some left.
All right.
But the trick with it is that most libraries want hard-spined books, right? Yeah, so you get got to wait for
we
the
might
trade.
Have something available next year for that.
Yeah.
So we'll have you back on to talk about it then. Rick, what's one of the best things you've read? Can you think of any really exceptional comics you've read recently?
I'm actually pretty ill-read. If there's an opposite to well-read, I'm ill-read these days when it comes to comic books. The one thing that I was... Again, trying to re-educate myself about was knocking characters out in silhouette. So I went back and I dragged out all my old Milk Caniff reprints Terry and from Steve Canyon, the kitchen sink stuff, particularly for Steve Canyon. So I think that stuff's still available, and it's well worth reading if you want to, like I say, brush up with the original guys, the guys on whose shoulders we stand.
Yeah, the Steve Canyon stuff is great. I haven't looked at that in a long time either. That's a good reminder to everybody is go back and look at the masters every once in a while. So Milton Caniff. Paul, anything that you've been reading that you really loved?
Yeah, actually, I've been going through and rereading the Goon collection. You've got all those Eric Howell's Goon, which I think is quite wonderful.
The Goon.
Yep, it's really nice.
So, okay, cool. So The Goon by Eric Powell, Milton Caniff, Steve Canyon, and then we had the Northlanders, Habibi, and Razzle also on the list. Mm-hmm. Also, I want to throw out one more. Also, if you go to cartoonarchy.com, speaking of public domain characters, Kim Holm recently completed his Pikmin's Model story by, I'm blanking on the author's name, Squids. He is the horror writer who always does like squids and disgusting imagery. You know what I'm talking about. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to get yelled at by so many people after this show. He's a favorite. Lovecraft. Thank you, Matt. Matt Dubay saves the day. Gosh. Squids. How does that help anybody? okay, but yes, that's at cartoonarchy.com if you want to check out another great, envisioning of a public domain story. So, okay, one last time. Where can we find Watson and Holmes if we want to purchase it or preview it? Brandon? Brandon, can you hear me? Am I still in?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Yeah, you're breaking up a bit.
Sorry. Where can we find Watson and Holmes? Where's the best place to get it?
Right now, Comics Plus.
Yeah, Comics Plus, which is an Android or iOS app. And there's a web interface, too, yeah? You can get it right off of the New
Paradigm. And again, if you go through newparadigmstudios.com, if you're interested in a print copy, we still have some. Send me an email through the site. There's like a question thing on the site. Mm-hmm. And right now we have a few shops in the area in New Jersey carrying the book. Right now we have Clockwork Comics and Cards that carry a few issues of them right now. So if you call them up, they might have some left.
Okay. So and then where else can we find you? Are you on Twitter? So you're NPS or NP Studios on Twitter, I know, but do you have a personal Twitter handle that people can follow?
Mine is, I think it's BPerlo NPS for me.
BPerlo NPS. What about you, Paul?
You know what? I actually cannot remember what my Twitter is right now. However, once I start posting on New Paradigm some more, then I will have one up.
But we do have a Facebook page with New Paradigm Studios, and we have a Watson and Holmes Facebook page where people can post too.
And Rick, there's no way we can reach you virtually, right?
No, this is it.
This is as close as you get,
after
kids.
I hang up, I'm gone.
Just a flash, and then he's gone.
Luddite.
Well, the offer still stands, Rick, if you want to come on to talk about fluidity and, you know, gesture and acting through your characters and everything. I think that'd be a great topic for discussion in the future.
Well, yeah. Well, now you know how to find me. I mean, I'm okay. Perfectly happy to talk about this stuff.
Great. So,
yarn away. Put them all to sleep. It'll
so
be great.
Two issues. Two issues are now available of Watson and Holmes, and they look great on your iPad or Android tablet, and then that's on Comics Plus, so go check it out. Thank you guys so much for taking time. We did not get through a tenth of what I wanted to talk about today, but that's, you know, why we always have follow-up later on. So once again, thank you to the Ann Arbor District Library for putting the show on every 2 weeks at Comics. Comics are great. TV is where we stream. This will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG68. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a guest, Raina Telgemeier. We're going to do an episode all about drama. Just talking about one book the whole time, just drama. And we're going to have a special guest, Skype guest, along with Raina, which will be a surprise. See you guys in 2 weeks, December 12th. Thanks once again to Brandon Perlow and Paul Mendoza and Rick Leonardi. It was a pleasure talking to you guys. Thanks so much. Thank you, Sharon Iverson.
Sure.
And thanks everybody for downloading.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And thanks everybody for downloading and listening.
Bye.
Until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.